This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
President Biden making some comments today about climate change and his policy plans in the absence of congressional action. And in keeping with that, Tim, Bloomberg Opinion columnist Eduardo Porter making the point that if climate is a crisis, should we keep gas prices high?
Eduardo Porter joins us now. He's a Bloomberg Opinion columnist with economic policy and immigration issues, joining us in the Bloomberg Interactive at Broker Studio. Eduardo, it's good to have you with us. This is a provocative column because you're essentially saying that a bold move that President Biden could make is to find a way to put a $5 a gallon floor on gasoline prices, literally the opposite of what he's trying to do in his world travels to get, you know, quote unquote, allies to give us more oil.
Yeah. I mean, the specific number is not the issue, $5, $4.50, whatever. But what's important to note is that high energy prices, which include high gas prices, are going to be an essential component of any solution to climate change. I mean, if we want to reduce carbon emissions, we have to make carbon fuels more expensive. And this is an opportunity.
Okay, what if you said, just to push back on that a little bit, what if you said, okay, it's all well and good, but if President Biden were to do something like that, this is such a politically toxic issue that he would get just destroyed in 2022 and then 2024 at the polls because this is the number one issue that Americans care about.
Indeed, I feel for the guy. This is a real tough one. But any solution to climate change is going to be politically very, very complicated. I mean, we've been debating this issue at least since the Obama administration. And remember what happened to his cap and trade program. It just died in flames, didn't even get to the Senate. And we've been trying and failing ever since. So the question is, yes, there is a very big political cost to pay. But at some point, this argument needs to be made and needs to be turned into policy because there is no other real solution.
Right. Or I would go, you know, none of this matters, right, if the climate continues to get warmer. I mean, just look at what's going on around the globe, right?
Yeah.
Like we debate about higher rates and margins and other stuff that's, you know, stressing us all out. But if the climate continues to warm, like, we will have nothing to worry about because we will not be able to exist.
Yeah, well, indeed.
I don't mean to get so dark, but right? Like, this is the crux of the major problem that faces the world right now.
Oh, right. I mean, just look at what's going on across Europe just now. And,
right.
And we've had versions of that in Australia, in the United States, and certainly in places like India and Bangladesh. I mean, the intensity of the climate emergency is amazing in terms of lives lost, crops lost, agricultural yields down, longevity shortened. I mean, the costs of this are extremely expensive, which is in fact what justifies imposing an economic cost to mitigate.
You cover Latin America, you cover U.S. economic policy, immigration, but I think about what Brazil did back in the 70s, right? They were brought to their knees because of the energy crisis, and they basically made themselves energy independent, right? Going into ethanol, sugar-based ethanol, right? They had to address it because they had to economically survive. You know, the U.S. has, Europe has higher taxes when it comes to gases. What is it that how come the Europeans did that? And why aren't the U.S. doing it? Is it because we've had so much fuel and you know, fossil fuel based fuels that we don't have to? Like, I mean, what is it?
Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, you could answer it in a variety of ways, I think. For one, Europe is much more welcoming of higher taxes than the U.S. is in any dimension, right? Whether it's taxes on energy, gasoline, or income taxes or whatnot, they pay a higher tax burden, and they accept it because they get a society that they like with that money. And the United States has always been much more hostile to that. Also, the U.S. has gotten used to very, very cheap energy for a long time. I mean, it's not just now that gas in Europe is more expensive. It's all, I mean, since I've been around, since I have memory, gas prices in Europe have been way higher than they are here.
Yeah, look no further than Norway, where we've seen gas prices above $10 a gallon, despite the fact that the country produces so much energy. Eduardo, before we let you go, you ran some numbers here. Talk about how this would spur innovation for alternatives.
I mean, well, basically what happens is the moment that consuming fossil fuels becomes more expensive, you'll have businesses and households looking for alternatives. One alternative is to use less energy, but another alternative is to find technologies that use different sorts of energies. And we've seen that. I mean, we see the amount of investment in renewable energies and in new technologies for, say, energy storage and whatnot is way higher. Precisely, I mean, it's also stimulated by government subsidies and so forth. But the prospect of much higher fossil fuel costs is driving this. I mean, you even have gas companies, energy companies that are going in to invest in nuclear fusion.
That's right. They know. Well, it's interesting. And if you wonder, if you think that it's like, you know, bottomless pits in terms of fossil fuels, Javier Blas has a great story in the Bloomberg talking about Saudi Arabia. They are the world's biggest crude producer, and they are nearing their ceiling when it comes to output, right? So it's going to run out. We know that, no doubt about it. We got to run. Come back. We loved it. So great to check in with Bloomberg Opinion columnist Eduardo Porto.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So the Bloomberg Big Take today, it's also a story in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, out on newsstands tomorrow, already on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's about the wunderkind quant-turned crypto billionaire and his dominance and expansion in that crypto industry.
We're talking about none other than Sam Bankman-Fried of FTX. This story by Hannah Miller and Olga Karif, as Carol mentioned, it's in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. Check it out, though, at the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Hannah Miller is digital currencies and venture capital reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us now on the phone from our Palo Alto bureau. Hannah, really great to have you with us. We've talked a little bit in recent days and recent weeks about the buying spree that Sam Bankman-Fried went on over the past couple of weeks, as we've seen the crypto industry just collapse, or past couple of months, I should say. What are his intentions in helping prop up some of these companies and then buying them as well?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. So it's been a really exciting time within the crypto industry, despite the market downturn. Sam Bankman-Fried has really spotted a lot of opportunities here to just consolidate power over the industry, whether it's striking deals with BlockFi or Voyager Digital. He's really, you know, just spreading his influence within this space.
All right. Remind us, for those who are like, wait, who is this dude? Because he really is a standout among those who are in this space, because he's worth a lot of money, right? He's probably lost some, but he's still worth a lot.
Yeah, he's worth about $10 billion currently to our Billionaires Index. That's about half of where his wealth was in April. Obviously still a lot of money. But he's 30 years old. He's taken the industry by storm. His companies, FTX and Alameda Research, have really asserted power within the industry. They work with a lot of top names. FTX is one of the most used crypto exchanges in the world.
So he's doing all of this out of the goodness of his heart, or does he just want to dominate and be the industry?
A lot of people within the industry see him as crypto's patron saint, that he is stepping in, bailing out companies out of the goodness of his own heart. But others see a business motivation here. He's really buying companies on the cheap. He is stepping in. He's helping out. But there's also a huge advantage in expanding his own business and gaining customers all over the world, particularly in the U.S.
Yeah, it's remarkable. There's a great infographic in here that really shows the web of companies that at this point are connected to FTX US, FTX, and then Alameda Research.
It's a lot, right?
All connected to Sam Bankman-Fried. Yeah. I'm wondering more about what Sam is like. And we've had a lot of reporting around him and some profiles of him, but you know, I think for people who might have seen his conversation yesterday with Matt Levine at the Bloomberg Crypto Summit would see that he was wearing his signature shorts and a t-shirt, really dressed unlike anyone else there, which has kind of become, you know, a signature for him. Tell us more about what he's like and who he is and how he got into crypto.
Yeah, no, Sam is always great to talk to. We spoke to him for this story. He is described by people as kind, nerdy, shy, a little bit awkward, but he really has a very calculating eye when he looks at the industry. He got into crypto trading a few years back, really sort of climbed the ranks in terms of trading performance with Alameda Research. And he really has become kind of a cult figure within the industry. And he's also pledged to give away most of his vast personal wealth.
I just love the shorts and the t-shirt. Hey, one thing I find interesting is that while he's spending and buying and looking to dominate when it comes to crypto, he's passed on some of the big flops as of late.
That's true. We have in our reporting that he spoke with Terra and Celsius about potential bailouts there, but he ended up passing on both. So it shows that he does have a discriminating eye here. He's not just bailing out whoever. You know, he's looking for advantages. He's looking at how it can help him and his companies.
What about when it comes to Robinhood and his investment in Robinhood? Because this one's a little bit different than the other companies. A lot of the companies that he's invested in or been interested in, those have been in the private markets. But Robinhood, it's publicly traded, and wow, it has gotten beat up.
Yeah, no. We reported a few weeks back that he was looking into a potential takeover at Robinhood. This shows that he has his eyes beyond the crypto industry, that he's looking at sort of more traditional finance players. As one of my sources said, his ambitions know no bounds. So it's really exciting to see him look at other areas. I mean, he's even joked about buying Goldman in the past.
That is wild. Well, he wants to do bigger deals, it sounds like. You know, Hannah, what is it that we need to understand about this individual, as the crypto space, still many who are knowledgeable, understand how it works, who are entrenched in this industry, say we're very early on in terms of the impact of the digital crypto world. So why is it that we need to keep an eye on him and what he does?
Well, I think with this current crypto winter, the industry is at a crossroads. A lot of people want a decentralized industry where power is in the hands of the people, that it's based on peer-to-peer transactions. But Sam's influence and that of FTX shows that there are clear centralized elements here, that there are major players to watch, and that they are going to have continued influence as this space grows.
Speaking of influence, you mentioned that he's been using his personal wealth, and he's also pledged to donate the vast majority of his personal wealth. What about when it comes to where he's putting his money politically right now? And if your reporting showed you at all, what he's thinking when it comes to influence in Washington?
Well, in 2020, he was one of the top political donors to Joe Biden during the presidential campaign, falling right behind Mike Bloomberg. And he's already spoken about his commitments to donating to the Democratic Party for the upcoming election, particularly if Donald Trump runs again.
Michael Bloomberg, of course, the founder of Bloomberg LP, Bloomberg Philanthropies, and of course, Bloomberg LP, the home of Bloomberg Radio and Bloomberg Business Week. It is interesting. So I think this is your world. So what are you watching to see in terms of what he does next?
Yeah, so we already know, and we reported today that FTX and FTX US are looking to raise more funding, which is pretty interesting during this time, because I've written a lot about how funding from venture capitalists has slowed when it comes to crypto. So he is definitely looking to expand. He has also spoken about buying assets from other distressed companies and even targeting Bitcoin miners.
Is there some nervousness, just got a few seconds left here, Hannah, that though there might be too much consolidation of the crypto world in one person's hands?
100%, especially considering that this is an industry that is supposed to be decentralized at its core.
It's kind of ironic. What a great deep dive. And it is, as we said, the Bloomberg Big Take. And of course, this is a story in the issue, new issue at Bloomberg Business Week, which will be out on newsstands, but already on the Bloomberg Terminal. And you can find it at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Hannah Miller, digital currencies and venture capital reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from our Palo Alto Bureau.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Business Week, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Checking out shares of Biogen. They're down about 6% in today's trade following an earnings update this morning. The company dealing with generic competition. And yet, Tim, it did boost its guidance for the year overall.
Let's get into it with Mike Perrone, Managing Director and Biotech Healthcare Specialist at Baird. Mike, this afternoon, joining us on the phone from New York City. Mike, how are you?
I'm great, Carolyn. Ken, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. Okay, we've had a few hours to dig into these results. Give us your takeaways from Biogen.
Yeah, so like most biotech stocks, clinical, regulatory, and strategic updates tend to be more important than quarterly earnings performance, and I think that's what you're seeing here with Biogen today. So Baird Biotech analyst Brian Scorney, in his preview note for Biogen last week, pointed out there's two main issues that investors are focused on with Biogen, and that's the CEO search, and that's also their Alzheimer's pivotal readout of lecanemab, which is expected in the fall. The lack of positive updates or positive commentary on any of these two seems to be trumping what otherwise was a really nice beat and raise by Biogen. So,
interesting. Yeah, no, it's really interesting that those two things are not actually are outweighing a beat and raise quarter from the company.
Yeah, and I'd also say, you know, if you take a look, you are seeing some general weakness in the larger commercial biotech stocks today, as we're seeing kind of a shift, as you mentioned, the biotech boom. You're seeing a shift from the safety, relative safety of those cash flowing large biotech stocks into some of the riskier areas of the biotech.
Well, so wait. So are you saying that there's some overall biotech industry trends that are weighing down Biogen today, or are you saying Biogen is weighing down the overall industry?
Yeah, Carol, I think it's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. The performance from Biogen on their earnings was strong. It's just really you know, those two issues which need to be resolved. And you know, there wasn't a whole lot of updates on the CEO search, and for the pivotal Alzheimer's readout, which is expected in the fall, you know, the company did point to a broad range of potential outcomes there, which I think based on conversations with investors may be taken as a slight negative.
So help us out here. What kind of CEO is needed for Biogen at this point? Like, I just remember years ago starting out, you know, when you talked about biotech, it was just like the upstarts, you know, and it's, you know, a lot of times there wasn't a lot of there's a lot of top line growth maybe, but not a lot of bottom line growth. It was tricky. I mean, this is a $30 billion market cap company. So how do we think about these companies, and what kind of CEO is needed to take this company into its next phase?
Yeah, I'll have to leave most of the commentary on Biogen going forward to our great biotech analyst, Brian Scorney, but certainly need some strong leadership there as far as some of the stumbles over the past few years. But I guess I'll leave the rest to we can touch base with Brian down the road.
What about when it comes to the Alzheimer's drug, which you pronounced so correctly and Carol and I have struggled with for months?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's similar mechanism to Aduhelm, which we know how it worked out, but it's a highly powered study. So, you know, the fact is that if there is an effect, they've powered it enough to have it have some positive readout. But again, the commentary today that they gave was somewhat pointing to a broader range of potential outcomes.
All right. So you are a biotech healthcare specialist. So I'm just curious, when it comes to the advice that maybe you give to your bigger, broader team, is biotech a group that you think investors need to be considering at this point? And where specifically? As I mentioned, it's up about 23% over the past month. So that's quite a bump to the upside. I know there's been some deal flow. Once again, and you know, when you think about biotech, you always think about the big pharma companies where they are looking for growth in particular. So what's the investment play, Mike, in your view at this point, when it comes to biotech?
Yeah, the big question a lot of investors have on this rally, is this a bear market rally or is this something that's more sustainable? And I'll say Strategus, a Baird company, did some really good macro research on historical kind of biotech bear market bounces. And, you know, they tend to be very strong and very quick. So it's a possibility that that's what we're seeing here and it could fade over time. But I'll tell you, our fundamental research team, the Baird Biotech research team, did note in their weekly a couple weeks ago that short covering, which drove a lot of the initial stages of the rally, can actually lead to institutional buying as people started having fear of missing out. Did I miss bottom? The stocks are still largely cheap. I mean, as much as we bounced off bottom, the XBI is still down roughly or a little bit over 50% from its peak in February of 2021. So we have seen some inbound calls from clients that suggest that there's some real work being done. It's something that's changed over the past few weeks. And you've also seen some fund flow shift where biotech was bleeding fund flows out for much of the year. And over the last month or so, we've seen some pretty positive inflows there, which means there's some real buying in biotech and could prove that this is more sustainable.
All right, we got to run. Thank you so much. Mike Perrone, Managing Director and Biotech Healthcare Specialist at Baird, joining us on the phone in New York City, although he's typically...
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Business Week, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Based in Milwaukee.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's get to it. We've just got about 10 and a half minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up that Wednesday trade. And we've got a new guest with us for the Drive to the Close.
Kirk McDonald is portfolio manager at Argent Capital Management. They've got approximately $3.3 billion in assets under management. Kirk joining us on the phone from St. Louis. Kirk, how are you?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me on the show, Carol and Tim.
Yeah, it's good to have you with us. Help us help our investing audience understand where the market is right now. There's this debate going on internally and externally about capitulation. Where do you fall?
So thanks for the question, Tim. And as far as capitulation goes, so the market, you know, had a horrible first half, and the mid-cap area where I work, it had its third worst first half since the inception of the Russell mid-cap benchmark in 1991. So while capitulation may or may not be upon us, when the market is down 21.6% like the Russell Midcap is, it's just an opportunity for investors like us. So at Argent Capital Management, we're looking to invest in the right company with positive change. And that huge drawdown in the market for us is positive change. We can pick up some companies we've been looking at for a long time at a much lower price.
I love the mid-cap space. We don't really talk about it a lot. I feel like it gets lost, certainly, between the big and small caps. But if you look at it, if I'm just looking at the S&P Mid-Cap 400, it's down about 15% this year. S&P 500 down almost 17%. And then, of course, the NASDAQ 100 still down more than both of those indices. How do you think about it? And is a lot of it kind of a U.S. play here?
Yeah, so the mid-cap space where I play is really just like anything that gets stuck in the middle, it gets forgotten about, and people don't talk about it, and they don't
allocate. It's like those middle children. Ask one of my sisters and brothers.
Hey, come on. I'm considered
like
a middle child.
They forget our birthdays.
I didn't want to pick on the middle child because I never know who might be listening and if they might get upset, but not having to live through the middle child syndrome myself, But yeah, so with mid-cap stocks, one of their advantages is they tend to be less exposed internationally than large-cap stocks. So in the case of you know, we're in right now with the dollar strong and the U.S. economy in a better position, although, you know, it's a tenuous position. It's better than some of the international economies. The mid-cap stocks have a good opportunity here right now to do a better job growing earnings relative to the rest of their competitors.
Where do you think we are in terms of recessions right now? Because I'm looking at your notes that you sent to our producer, Paul Brennan, and I'm having a hard time understanding, you know, where we are in this economy. We've got mortgage rates spiking, and of course, we've got demand falling for homes, but they're remaining expensive. We've got energy prices just skyrocketing and inflation the highest it's been in 40 years. Yet the workforce is, you know, still adding jobs. So where are we?
Yeah, so right now, where the economy is, it's still not technically in a recession whatsoever. And the way we invest here at Argent Capital, we're really bottom-up stock pickers, you know, looking for the right company with positive change. But we do take into account a little bit where we are in the market cycle. We try to be one-third invested, you know, for the current market cycle, which has been an expansion phase lately. So that involves more value type of stocks. But the next phase, should it be a recession, would it be more of the steady growers, the companies that can grow their earnings regardless of where we are in the economic cycle.
Right.
We keep one-third of the portfolio exposed and ready for that type of a change in the cycle. So that's really how we look at it. We're not going to change how we invest based on are we going to have a recession or not. We're prepared for either scenario.
Right. So, and you look, like you said, bottoms up. So you're looking at names specifically, and you have brought a few with us to chat about. One is the ticker is LNG. We're talking about Cheniere Energy, based in Houston. Stock's up almost 34% so far this year. I get it, like the energy play, but they are very much involved in the infrastructure part of it, right? The pipelines?
So Cheniere isn't the pipeline. So really what they do is they create the liquefied natural gas. So they build these huge expensive projects that cost $1 billion or $2 billion each.
The terminals,
natural
right?
Gas.
Yeah.
Yeah, the terminals.
Right.
So it is delivered
by
pipeline.
Yeah.
So they're more, but they are more of the infrastructure play. You're exactly right. So they charge their customers a combination. It's based on the Henry Hub price of natural gas plus a liquefaction fee. So they do make more money if the price of natural gas goes higher, but they're really the play on the fact that in this case, Europe, and that's the change that we were looking at, is now needs to switch their natural gas supplier from Russia to other sources. And the United States is a natural play for that. We're a very reliable supplier, one of the biggest producers of natural gas. And Cheniere Energy is the world's largest producer of liquefied natural gas.
All right. What about Zebra Technologies, ZBRA? It's a mid-cap stock. It's not one we talk about a lot here, and you argue that that's to your advantage.
Yeah, that is absolutely to my advantage. And Zebra is a long-term holding of ours. So they're the largest producer of barcode scanners and printers in the world, and also RFID tags for tracking inventories. And the positive change for Zebra has been really this move to omni-channel retailing. So we like to buy things, and I do it every single day on my phone. I get it delivered in a day or two, or I sometimes drive by the store and pick it up, you know, in the parking lot. And they now produce software that enables retailers to do that omni-channel retailing. And also, they produce software and the tracking technology for the distribution centers that all of the online retailers, and now the omni-channel retailers, are increasingly building as well. And Zebra, you know, really is not well known, but it's around us every single day. And I guarantee you, most of us will come in contact to it
right.
with it two or three times a week, but have no idea.
Especially as I do my self-checkout. No, but I'm curious, though, why is it down so much, 50%, almost 50% year-to-date?
Yeah, so Zebra, really, it's down almost in sympathy with the rest of the tech sector, which was the worst performing sector in the Russell Midcap in the first half of the year.
Yeah.
And it's down largely in sympathy with that sort of a
decline. It's down a lot more, though, wouldn't you say?
It is down more, and part of that is I think it had a huge run towards the end of last year.
Okay.
And what I saw with some of the stocks in my portfolio and in the market in general, the names that had a huge run-up at the end of last year were the worst performers early this year. But at Argent Capital Management, we really look to own companies for the long term. We have very low turnover, about 20% a year. So we're not as concerned with the fact that Zebra stock price is down. What we're looking at is the quality of that business right there, and that the positive change to omnichannel retailing is going to continue. So Zebra really has a tailwind for sales growth going forward.
I was just counting. It's up 754% from the end of 2015 through the end of last year. So it has had quite a run. So you're right. All right, we got to run. So good to check in with you. Thank you so much. Kirk McDonald over at Argent Capital Management.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation, and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA, and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global, and Schneider Electric. Visit BloombergLive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.